Good afternoon, everybody. I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:32 p.m. on Thursday, January 18th. We're meeting in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. And today's committee members are Senator Dunbar, Senator Geisel, Vice Chair Kaufman, and Senator Tobin, and myself, Senator Wilson. We do have a full complement and a quorum to conduct business this afternoon. And welcome back, and Happy New Year for those folks. And it's wonderful for some folks to be back home and others here in this wonderful capital city. This afternoon, we will hear an update from the Department of Health. Here in the room today is Commissioner Hedberg and Deputy Commissioner Ritchie, and available for questions on the phone. Oh, we got to log into the right committee room here. Oh, there we go. All right, and online, we do have a full complement of all the division directors. We have Dr. Ann Zink, she's not on yet. Oh, there she is. She's online for questions. And we also have Director Dumpling, the Division Director of Behavioral Health, Tony Newman, the Director of Division of Seniors and Disability Services, Renee Gearhart, Division of Healthcare Services, Lindsay Cato, the Director of Division of Public Health, Deb Efferidge, the Director of Public Assistance, and Leah Van Kirk, the Healthcare Policy Analyst. So you have lots of lifelines, Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner Ritchie. Please come up to the... And since we have lots of folks and lots of similar voices, just remember when you switch in between each other for ease of records, if you can just restate your name for the record, so just be easier for folks to follow along. And we'll just take a pause at the end of each slide if there's questions from committee members, so we can just go from there. But the floor is yours, Commissioner.
For the record, my name is Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner for the Department of Health, and thank you for inviting us to present a department overview of the work that's happened over the last 12 months and the work that's going to happen over the coming 12 months. Next slide. So it is very exciting. July 1st, 2023, we celebrated our one-year anniversary as the Department of Health. And I will say that it has been an incredibly busy year. We have really been focusing in on stakeholder engagement around the healthcare system, behavioral health, and child care. And that that focused engagement has really been focused in four arcs of effort around behavioral health, complex care, transformation of care, and child care. And we're going to be talking about all four of those today. Transformation of care is not in the slide deck, but we will be talking about it at the end of the slides. We have made a lot of progress over the last year, and we continue to meet our deliverables and our milestones and really look forward to accelerating a lot of the work that we have been building over the past year. As a reminder, on slide two, it really just reflects the five divisions that make up the Department of Health. So in slide three, this is again going to be the topics that we'll be covering today. We are open to any questions that you have on any of these slides. So I'm going to first start and just, we have two slides, and I want to provide just an update on SNAP, also known as food stamps. When I started this role as commissioner for the Department of Health in November of 2023, that is when I, or 22, that is, I inherited a backlog. And with new Division of Public Assistance leadership, with a new business process redesign, really a dedicated team, focused team specifically on the backlog, we were able to work through and eliminate that initial backlog. And we were able to enjoy the staff were very happy with processing timely applications for a short period of time. This fall, there were just a cascade of quick events that created this current backlog that I'm going to talk about today. The first one was there was one last remaining waiver from the feds, and it was a waiver on interviews. And that ended on September 30th. And so that meant that all states needed to start interviewing as a requirement of administering the SNAP program. What we found as our staff who were new in their roles, the average time was around 96 minutes for completing a single interview. And so staff were really, while they were completing the interviews, they weren't able to really be processing those applications. So that's really what kind of accelerated the backlog. In addition, we, as part of our transformation of IT, it was planned, but we moved our document management system from a server to the cloud. And so there was a delay, a lag of the processing of applications. The third, which was unplanned, was there was a series of winter storms that closed through South Central Alaska, Kenai Peninsula, and Matsu, that shut state offices and schools down and through a period of time. It's sort of like that culmination is really what accelerated that backlog. I do receive updates, and as soon as the division director and I saw that there was a backlog, we reached out immediately to the feds to ask for a waiver temporarily on interviews to pause them so that we could focus in on training. The feds came back and said no and declined our waiver. I, prioritizing getting the benefits out, really said it's more important that we focus on getting the benefits out. We see the value of interviews, but we need to focus on the training. And so we are temporarily pausing the interviews, accepting client statements, and those are the immediate actions we're taking. At the peak, as you can see on this slide, there was about 12,000 SNAP applications that were backlogged as of December 8th. Today, we are 6,233. I asked the team what is their weekly goal, and they said between 950 to 1,200 per week. The team continues to meet their weekly goals, and they will eliminate that backlog by the end of February. So, you know, our big focus right now is we know what caused the backlog. How do we prevent this from happening again? And there's a couple of things we're focusing on. One is we had support from our existing contractor to come in and work with our training team and look at how are we training our staff? How can we improve training? And we know that we need to circle back and do additional training on how to conduct interviews so that eligibility technicians are only asking the pertinent questions, not all of the questions on the form, as an example. Two is through the workflow process management system, we're able to see the timely processing of applications, and we're able to identify when an eligibility technician may need additional assistance, and we can follow up with additional training. So we're starting to work on that right now in order to prepare us. Once this backlog is done, we will start doing interviews again, and we want to maintain that timely processing. So there's sort of focusing on the staff, focusing on the training. We continue to recruit and train new staff. We have 22 new eligibility technicians that are starting training, and they're going to be focusing in on Medicaid. That's the first program. So we do continue to have staff that continue to apply. We are starting, it's a difficult job, so we continue to see turnover, but we are slowly starting to see a decrease in vacancies and a decrease in turnover. It is small, though, so I just want to caution that. Next slide.
Wait, sorry. If we go back to the previous
slide. Yes.
Senator Tillman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I'm cautiously optimistic that this will be the case by the end of February. I do just want to dial in a little bit more on the winter storm effects. I think many state departments and local municipalities were significantly impacted by those once-in-a-lifetime storms that seem to keep happening. However, I know that there were things that the state could have been doing, like more robust plowing. And I'm curious to know what conversations you've had with other departments about the impact to your department that failures on their behalf might have created a cascade effect. And I'm also curious to know if you've set up remote work policies so that if and when these types of situations happen again, there are redundancies that we can deploy to ensure that the processing still happens in a timely manner.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Tobin, We do have a telework policy, and so we do allow our eligibility technicians to telework. What we were really seeing, it was just a culmination of school closures. A lot of our employees are families, and they have kids. So it wasn't just the school offices being, or the offices being closed. It was also school. So it was a culminating effect. No, I have not reached out to other departments to talk about snow plowing.
Please continue.
So as I, for the record, this is Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner for the Department of Health. I talked about how we are supporting staff with really focusing in and dialing in our training. Again, adult learners are very different from, early learners, and so making sure that our staff have the tools to train adults. The second part is IT solutions, and we have three wheels, and it's the workforce, how we're supporting our workforce, ensuring our policies are updated, and ensuring that our IT systems are all working together. And that's really the big three focus, is that all three are working in concert with each other. We want to increase the automation to support our staff so our staff are working at their highest level. We're very appreciative. Last year, the legislature appropriated capital funds to overhaul our IT systems, and we're really starting to see the fruits of those funds come to fruition. So as I mentioned earlier, November of 2023 is when our document management system moved from a server to the cloud. In addition, last weekend, is when the ARES system moved from the server to the cloud. Having both of these systems now in the cloud, what it allows us to do is it's enhanced security around data, it's improving the reliability, and it's updating our technology infrastructure so our staff, our network services, and our contractors are able to upload and apply these new modules. And so that's where we're going to start to see an acceleration in the tools for clients and our eligibility technicians to help process these applications. So what I would like to do is just kind of walk through over the next 8 months the tools that will be coming online. January 27th is when we launched our SNAP online application. We did it very quietly. We wanted to see, if it was going to work. Yes, there was lots of testing that happened, but we just wanted to have kind of a quiet rollout. The SNAP online application is a portal on MyAlaska. So if you go to your permanent fund dividend and you scroll down, you can apply for Medicaid, you can apply for SNAP. There's also a link on our state website. What we found in the first week was over 500 clients applied for SNAP, and we were not seeing any issues. And so then we issued a press release and we announced to everyone that the SNAP online application was live. And it's been going really well. We've had a roughly around 1,100 SNAP applications. What we are seeing, and this is preliminary data, is that the time to complete an application is short. I actually tested the system myself. I applied, and it will prompt you with a question, and that's yes or no. If I answer yes, a list of other questions scroll down. If I answer no, then I advance to the next section. And that's how clients are able to go through and complete the application faster. In addition, if I answer yes, then it's going to prompt me to upload documentation to verify my answer. And so that prompting is really ensuring that we have a completed application. Right now, or before, it was a paper application. Sometimes there was supporting documentation, sometimes there's not. And so we're seeing a lot more completed documents because it is online. The client can also apply on their phone or they can apply on a computer. And so that modality is really helpful as well. We're also seeing that our clerical staff that are working with the customers, that are coming into the offices, they can have more face-to-face time with those customers because they're not spending as much time resizing those documents because everything is online. So there's a lot of efficiencies simply by launching that online application that was several years in the working. The next is first quarter of 2024. It's sort of a two-phased approach. So the first phase is a self-service portal. So clients can upload any document for any public assistance program, not just SNAP, but also Medicaid, adult public assistance. So that is really going to help having another avenue for clients to upload documents. So that's the first phase of the self-service portal that will launch first quarter. This spring, it's a required document. USDA requires that we have a mid-year check. So right now we have 12-month certification period. So at 6 months, we need to have that client just update if there's any SNAP changes. That's going to go live this spring. So again, it's easier for that client to update their any changes on their SNAP application. And then in addition, this spring, it's called Advanced Capture Intelligence Scanning. It's going to be a phased approach, but it's really leveraging technology. So when, as an example, a SNAP application comes in through the document management system, this new module called Engage will be able to scan it and say, this is an initial SNAP application. It goes into this queue, into the workflow process, and is assigned to an eligibility technician. So it's really taking away that manual process of shifting those applications around. The next phase is the second phase of the self-service portal will be the ability for clients to check the status of their application. Right now, you need to call the virtual contact center. Sometimes there's a wait time, sometimes there's not. It depends on which queue you go into. Once this self-service portal launches, you'll be able to log in and check your status and see if the eligibility technician is waiting for additional documentation, or if an interview needs to be scheduled, or if your application has been completed and approved. So it's really going to help that client. And we anticipate there will be a decrease in calls to our virtual call center. And then finally, this summer, it's called e-notifications or electronic notifications. Right now, everything is mailed out via snail mail. And so it's an opt-in. And so clients can now opt in and choose to receive e-notifications, and that will launch at the end of the summer. So again, by our systems moving to the cloud, it allows us the ability to now more easily change in a more secured environment and bring these tools on to support our eligibility technicians and to support the client's experience. Finally, we still are on track for launching our integrated eligibility enrollment system in 2025. Our contractors are meeting their deliverables and their milestones.
Thank you. We have a few questions. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. So you and I have spoken about the summer EBT program and school lunches for kids and the approximately $7 million the state of Alaska has sort of declined to receive from the federal government for that purpose. And you've described to me, you know, this cumbersome process wherein the school districts figure out how many kids need it and give that to the Department of Education. And then they give like a Excel spreadsheet, essentially, that has been manually uploaded by the Department of Public Assistance, I believe. So I'm wondering if this IT process, you know, you said we have this self-service portal that you can do everything, not just SNAP. Is there a way to integrate that program to help reduce our admin, or any other way to try to use this IT update to reduce those kind of that administrative burden, so that hopefully we can start to receive those funds to get school lunches for kids?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I thank you for that question. It's a really good question. I think, you know, the decision not to start the summer EBT program was intentional because it's a heavy administrative burden. And our primary focus is really focusing on the SNAP backlog and these IT, the system changes and the tools that need to come online. I think once we're in a position where all of this is launched, I think that's when this is a new program that needs to be built out into our, you know, the IT system, whether it's the integrated eligibility system or ARIES, whatever system it is, it needs to be built out. So that will take some time so that it is not a manual process, but it can be automated. So I think that We have not said no. We have not said yes. We've just said we need to pause while we focus on these IT system changes and removing these manual processes so we can get to a point where we can really evaluate that program. I would say, in addition, Food Nutrition Services, FNS, did reach out to us, and they kind of looked at where they looked at our plan. We've been very transparent with the work that we're doing and sort of the decision not to apply this year. And I think that there's concurrence, like, you have a lot of work in front of you. But we've also asked, is there another way that we can leverage that program to support communities? That's an ongoing conversation that we have, that we need to follow up with FNS to see how we can support communities in administering this program. But there's no decisions yet.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I think the idea to use some of the smaller communities, or rather to try to direct it to the community rather to the individual, makes sense. In the more urban districts like Anchorage, I don't think it does. I think it makes sense to use the program as it's been done elsewhere. I guess my question is, you know, when I'm a little concerned about doing this IT upgrade and then us coming back next year and saying, well, we didn't build this IT upgrade in such a way that it can accommodate receiving this program. You know, just having been in my previous time in Anchorage, you know, we asked SAP to build a very specific thing, and then we wanted to do other things, and of course it was extremely expensive to go back and change it. So I'm wondering, when you're doing this update in the coming months, again, you said you haven't made a decision one way or another, but can you build this in such a way that anticipates so that we could receive it without having to do a lot of really costly changes to the programs that we are building and purchasing now?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Denmark, I think that we can follow up with you. I think we just need time to kind of evaluate the timeline and the resources we have and what needs to happen in order to administer the program.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Provide that to the committee. That'd be wonderful as well.
Yes.
Thank you. Any other questions? I do have a question on some of the SNAP updates and just moving toward, looks like, a little bit more automation to support staffs. Looks like a lot of AI functions through phone calls and other issues. Have you seen any, I guess, that uptick and just more complaints of, I just want to talk to a live person, or these automations are a little bit more cumbersome, or do you have any, I guess, feedback from the client's perspective on how some of these automations are going for their ease of use?
To the chair, we've only launched the online application, and I did receive one email, and it was an error message, and we were able to figure out that it was how the client was uploading or trying to upload the documents. So we did receive one. I'm not aware of any other complaints specific to the SNAP online application. It is something that we are very much thinking about and receptive to if there's any feedback. And I think as these tools come online, because there's a lot of changes that's going to happen over the next 8 months, I think that's something that we're definitely going to be watching, and we can let you know.
Thank you. Please continue.
So for the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner for the Department of Health. Switching topics, childcare. What I would like to do is talk about several of the funding initiatives and provide an update, and then transition and provide an update on the Governor's Task Force on Childcare. So first is, you'll notice innovations is on the slide. There was... the Child Care Program Office received ARPA funds, and they used $14 million of the ARPA funds and issued it to THREAD, which is a statewide organization, to administer the Innovation Grant Program. There was a lot of requests for innovation grant applications. 17 awards were issued this year. And I wanted to, of the 17, I just kind of wanted to highlight for you some of the work that has been started that I think is going to support increasing access to childcare. So as an example, in Homer, South Peninsula Hospital used these innovative funds to start up and develop an employer-sponsored child care program for the hospital employees. In Sitka, they're piloting a therapeutic child care program. Children that have therapeutic behavioral health needs and parents who need child care, they're working together so there's a therapeutic child care center to meet those behavioral health needs. In Copper River Census area, they were able to increase their child care capacity from 35 to 70. In Juneau, they actually created an apprenticeship program, which is paid for so that they can really have another avenue to increase their workforce in Juneau. In Nome, they created a job training center and early childhood education opportunities, again, focusing on that local workforce. Huna is opening a long-planned child care facility. It's the first licensed child care facility in Huna, and it's part of their economic development. And in Anchorage, we saw four partners come together and build a co-op, and they're providing full-time care for 52 children. So we've saw a lot of really great innovations around that grant. Federal funded, went through THRED, and they issued out those grant awards. The second area I wanted to give an update is workforce stabilization. Last year, the legislature appropriated $7.5 million for workforce stabilization. The fastest mechanism we had to get the money out the door and to the individual child care workers was through the organization THRED. They have a program called Roots. And so they did a very robust, you know, notification out to all of the child care workers. They needed to apply for a Roots award. That application period closed on Monday, January 15th. And those payments will be going out in February. And so that's to the individual child care worker. And we can report out on the number of awards once we receive that. The third, and this is not on the slide, and the grant opportunity just opened today. The remaining ARPA funds that the Child Care Program Office received in it, and I need to confirm the amount, it's between $10 to $14 million. They just opened up a grant opportunity today to all licensed and approved child care workers. It's non-competitive. It is formula-based. So if a child care center has 5 or 10 or 15, that's the funding amount they receive is what they are licensed for. The funding will be used to support rent, mortgage, utilities, facility payments, personnel, benefits, premium pay, recruitment, retention, for supplies, also support around mental health support for children and employees, and then the last element is family support for tuition assistance. So again, the remaining ARPA funds went to THRED. THRED is administering out, and it's a formula based, so all of the licensed and approved child care providers can apply for those funds. Really looking, and it's not stabilization funds, but it's really helping with those remaining funds to help them as these other initiatives are starting to get more embedded in these communities. So switching topics from the funding that has gone out, I just wanted to spend just a little bit of time and talk about the governor's task force on child care. The governor issued an administrative order, 346, and the membership is very statewide. We have from Juneau to Kotzebue, we have representation from all over the state, and we have representation from all types of child care providers. And looking at the work that was identified through the administrative order and really how do we increase access to child care, we took the topics and divided it into six topic areas. Three of them was around background checks, licensing, and workforce. And so the task force focused on those three areas. Two additional topic areas came out of that, employer-based services and tribal authority. But there's a report and there's 33 recommendations on how to reduce the burden on background checks. How do we increase, you know, navigation of licensing, increase workforce capacity, incentivize employer-based services, and tribal authority. And so there's really some of those recommendations the Department of Health has already started to implement, and as resources become available, we'll continue to implement these recommendations. The second report, so the task force finished that work, issued the recommendations to the governor, and yesterday we had started up again, and we're focusing now on quality, access, and subsidies. Those conversations will go from January to July. We do have a contractor that's looking at a cost of care study, the first time something like that has been done in Alaska, really looking at how much does it cost to provide childcare in Alaska, and we look forward to that report and those recommendations that will be finalized in July and submitted to the governor. With that, I will close and see if there's any questions.
Yes, you said there are six. I see five. Are the recommendations from the child care?
Yes, so that's a little confusing. There was six topics. Background checks, licensing, and workforce were three. The task force added two in the first report. And then the next three is access, quality, and subsidies. And that will be the second report.
Right.
Yeah.
And with the first recommendations, I understand the total report won't be done till next year. But with these first 33 recommendations, are we going to see any of these into action in the government?
To the chair, yes.
Thank you. We look forward to seeing that. Any other questions on the slide? I think Senator Tobin also participated on the child task force, so thank you for your work, Senator.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Emily Ricci, and I am Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health. And on slide seven, we're going to provide an update on the Medicaid redetermination process. So I want to start by just reorienting the committee to what the Medicaid redetermination process is. In response to the public health emergency in 2020, states were generally required to maintain continuous eligibility for all Medicaid recipients, and they were not able to disenroll them except for very specific reasons. That continuous eligibility requirement was in effect for approximately 3 years. That ended at the end of March in 2023, and all states were required to begin a historic and, quite frankly, challenging process of reviewing eligibility determinations for all Medicaid recipients in their programs over a specific time period using specific criteria. So I wanted to talk a little bit about where we're at today. We're about 10 months into that process. Medicaid eligibility and redeterminations are managed through the Division of Public Assistance. So the same team that is working to address the SNAP challenges that Commissioner Hedberg spoke about in earlier slides is the same division that's tasked with undertaking the Medicaid redeterminations. And, you know, when we step back to think about, you know, given the challenging environment the division is facing, how do we need to position ourselves to be successful in undertaking this effort? We realized that one of the things we needed additional time in order to complete redeterminations. So one of the first things we did was negotiate with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services additional time to complete our Medicaid redetermination. So most states have a 12-month period in order to initiate and complete redeterminations. We negotiated an additional 6 months. So we actually have an 18-month period in order to initiate and complete most redeterminations. We also thought about how are we going to contact Alaskans? We are heavily reliant on mail, and we know that Alaskans, particularly in the summer months and the fall months, are engaging in fishing and hunting and subsistence activities. So we asked the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, can we delay initiating redeterminations in rural areas until late fall or early winter, and we received approval to do that. We also implemented a number of other mitigation strategies. These are available online in mitigation plans. These are updated regularly as new mitigation measures are made available by CMS as they respond to the challenges that Alaska and other states are facing across the nation as we undertake this process. In general, we have implemented probably over 24 or 26 different mitigation strategies working with the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. One of the most important mitigation strategies that we're seeing is the ability to initiate a renewal at the same time an individual SNAP application is being redetermined. And that has been surprisingly impactful. If you look at the first data on this slide, you can see that we've initiated over 90,000 redetermination. And those are redeterminations that have been initiated through the ex parte or the automated process. So those are redeterminations that have been scheduled where we're identifying individuals in our system that we need to begin the redetermination process for. That number does not include individuals whose Medicaid status has been renewed when a technician in the eligibility technician in the Division of Public Assistance is processing their SNAP application. So through that additional mitigation measure, we've actually processed an additional 40,000 renewals, which you will see in the numbers that are viewed on the next slide. So through the use of our mitigation measures, we have been trying to proactively identify and address the ongoing challenges with this process. And I keep stepping back between, because when I meet with other Medicaid directors across other states and I listen to the focus from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services on this process, this is a nationwide challenge that many states are rising to meet. Many states have implemented new mitigation strategies. And when I think about the requirements that states are, the new requirements that states are following in terms of leveraging new automated or ex parte processes, the new timelines that states are working with in this, you know, I think 3 years from now, 4 years from now, these will result in better processes for Medicaid programs and for members. But they are new, and the volume that is occurring right now is very challenging for everyone. So I see this being very beneficial in the future, but it is a challenge to work through right now. One of the new and beneficial aspects of this process is some of the access that we've been able to share in different ways through different means with our different healthcare partners. So, for example, we were able to leverage the health information exchange in a different way than we have in the past, and we were actually able to upload or to identify individuals whose Medicaid eligibility was up for redetermination and who needed to return a renewal form. The HIE was able to connect them with a provider if they were impaneled with a provider and actually push a notification to the provider letting them know that one of their patients needed to return a Medicaid renewal form. We never used the HIE in that way before, and so this is something that I think we can think about how to leverage this in the future. We are also sharing information with our tribal health organizations as well on a monthly basis so that they know who they need to reach out to and support them in returning paperwork if that individual needs to return paperwork during that time period. Some of the other important mitigation measures that we've implemented also include providing additional time for individuals who have not returned their renewal form to return that form and to be reinstated retroactively back to the point of disenrollment. And finally, we now have texting available. When we started in April, we were not able to proactively send a text to individuals whose Medicaid status was up for redetermination, but beginning at the end of October, we developed that texting capability. So we're now able to reach out and let people know that we're waiting for them to return a renewal form. So again, all of the changes that we put in place, I think will pay future dividends in terms of improving the system, as well as helping us work through the process that we have right now. I do want to spend a little bit of time talking through what we call the ex parte or the automated process. This process is one of the requirements that states had to implement beginning April 1st, and really the intent is to try to leverage external data sources that may be able to determine a member's continued eligibility without either a technician or the individual having to submit additional information. So Alaska and other states stood this process up beginning in April, and like any new process, some of it worked very well, but there's other areas where we see opportunities for improvement. So towards the end of August or the beginning, well, really towards the beginning of August, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services noticed across the nation a higher number than they anticipated of individuals, particularly children, who were being disenrolled for procedural reasons. And so they asked all states to conduct a specific test of their ex parte systems to determine if there were any errors that were contributing to the national trends they were seeing. Alaska, along with more than 24 other states, did identify an error in their system. We identified that towards the end of August or the beginning of September. At that point, we paused certain disenrollments, particularly for individuals or families who might have been impacted by that error. The Division of Public Assistance team went back. They reviewed those cases that would have been impacted, reinstated those who were impacted, and completed that work by December 1. In the meantime, given the widespread nature of these system errors, the federal government offered states additional support with the CMS digital service team to come meet with states, review their systems, and identify how to prioritize and implement updates to address these errors and really leverage the ex parte system. Our Division of Public Assistance team took advantage of that support and has been working with a digital service under the Centers for Medicaid and Medicaid Services. We have a series of updates that will be implemented beginning in January and February and later on through the end of the fiscal year. While those updates are underway, we have continued to pause certain procedural disenrollments to make sure that those system errors aren't affecting more people. However, we are continuing to initiate redeterminations so that we can approve those cases that are eligible for renewal. We can disenroll those individuals who we know are no longer eligible, but we're not disenrolling individuals who may be affected by this error. So we're continuing to make progress, but we're pausing in some key areas. When the updates are complete, we will work through those procedural disenrollments that have been paused, and we will continue with the redetermination process.
Any questions on this slide?
I want to say that, one of the things that were happening in the news and you read, the paper or see on TV about our error rates or other items, and I wish you guys would talk about this piece, is that, when I was doing the Health Chairs Conference and I was able to lead the Medicaid Innovation Summit for CSG, is that Alaska is one of the best states that has one of the lowest error rates, and we actually did quite well throughout this process up till, I guess that was September, it was up to that data for that. I wish you guys would have talked more about some of the success that you guys had, and that we're not that bad. We're leading sort of the states and sort of doing our redeterminations, and I wish that would have got out there more to help the staff morale, because they are doing a great job of the redetermined process, and we're not that off. But I do have a question in terms of, you said that you have a later date for rural entities that people that live in rural areas for a later start date. Is that date then pushed back, and you have the 18 months upon the pushback on those dates? Because so now you're going to have two sort of end dates for an urban and rural, and how do you determine urban and rural?
To the chair, Senator Wilson, it's a little bit complicated. To the degree that we can initiate renewals through the ex parte process, we delayed initiating those renewals through the ex parte process if individuals lived in certain rural areas, and we leveraged the rural area definition that I believe is used by SNAP or is in place with the Division of Public Assistance. That has begun already. We started those in November, so those are underway. There were some individuals who lived in rural areas whose eligibility would have been renewed anyway during the summer and early fall months, and in those cases we were not able to pause those redeterminations in our system. So there were some individuals that we were able to hold and wait until those winter months, and some whose eligibility and renewals did start in the summer and early fall months. And I only share that because, as we think about just the varying areas where individuals are living and the different mechanisms that we're using to identify individuals for renewals, either because we're processing their SNAP application or because we're running them through the ex parte process, the additional 8 months that we negotiated with CMS, 8 months now because we're 10 months in, has given us the ability to really be flexible in terms of trying to manage some of the volume that we are putting through that system. So I believe that we have sufficient flexibility to try to care for those rural determinations over the next several months. But if for some reason that bleeds into the spring or into the summer months, we have a number of other mitigation measures that are in place now that were not in place in April, including the data sharing that's occurring with our tribal health organizations and longer retroactive reinstatement for individuals who return renewals later.
Thank you. And just for your time check, you're about halfway through and you're about halfway done with time. So and we'll pick just a little bit.
So moving on to slide 8, for the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. As I said earlier, we have an 18-month period to conduct our redeterminations, and you can see here we have scheduled out for the next 9 months approximately 11,300 renewals or redeterminations every month. On the left-hand side of the chart, you can see the green lines, and those that are renewals that have been initiated. Some have been completed. Some are still in that procedural disenrollment phase. So this represents the renewals that have been initiated and some of which have been completed. But what my takeaway from this slide that's important is that while we can predict and plan for a static volume of redetermination cases, the reality is a lot more complicated. And there's a lot of fluctuation in volume from any given month. But again, given where we're at right now in December, the combination of the renewals as a result of SNAP applications and the redeterminations, I think having the additional 9 months gives us the flexibility we need to manage that volume. So moving on to slide 9, moving out of Medicaid eligibility and redeterminations, moving into Medicaid savings and tribal reclaiming, this is always an important slide to share with the committee and with the legislature. It's very important from the Department of Health's perspective to really identify how we can most effectively utilize our general funds in supporting the Medicaid program. And the Division of Healthcare Services, run by Director Renee Gayhart, has really done a tremendous job of establishing and leveraging opportunities to have 100% federal match for services that are provided to a Medicaid beneficiary who is also a member of a tribal health organization. And so you can see here the maturity of this program from when it first started in year one with $34 million in general fund savings to the year 2023. And there's been a significant jump this year. We've been able to achieve approximately $124.5 million in general fund savings. This is really attributable to the work that Healthcare Services undertakes. And there's a couple of reasons why you see a jump between state fiscal year 2022 and 2023. One of those is because we're continuing to identify where we can create a system to leverage this additional federal funding for different types of claims. And so in state fiscal year 23, we were able to begin to leverage additional federal funding for behavioral health claims. So that was a new addition, as well as out-of-state hospitals who are treating beneficiaries who are eligible for those funds. We have also seen in general an increase in utilization, particularly in transportation, as individuals begin to travel again and begin to utilize more healthcare services. And so we're able to leverage additional tribal reclaiming for some of those services as well. But we view this as a good news slide. So moving on to slide 10, I want to talk a little bit about some of the Medicaid payment changes that have occurred. Some of you may be familiar with the concept of diagnosis-related groups. This is really a payment mechanism that moves away from kind of a per diem or a fee-for-service payment system with inpatient hospitals and moves to a payment system that really focuses on acuity, the intensity of services, and the duration of stay. And so this has been a long-term project between the Office of Rate Review, the Division of Healthcare Services, and the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. This went live on January 1, 2024, so we are about 2.5 weeks into this transition. And so far, there's a couple of wrinkles that we have to sort out, but so far it appears to be working well. And so this is an example of, I think, really good collaboration between various divisions and units of the Department of Health and the impacted stakeholders. I also want to talk about another project that the department is undertaking that I think will interest this committee and that you will hear about over the next several years. We are undertaking a comprehensive review of the rates and the rate methodologies for Medicaid services. We intend to review all Medicaid services, but that is quite a lot of Medicaid services, so we are starting in phases. The first phase will focus on kind of priority items for us right now, which is behavioral health, rates and rate methodology, long-term care services and supports, so home and community-based waivers, federally qualified health centers, and non-emergent medical transportation. The goal is to review the underlying rate methodology and evaluate whether there are ways that we can improve that, if other states have taken a different approach, and if our current methodologies fundamentally align with the state's goals in terms of the outcomes that we want to see and the things that we want to promote. I'm a big believer that the system will respond to how you pay it. And so I think it's really important to look at how and what we are paying for. And we have the opportunity to do that. We understand that this has to be done, and our view and our perspective is that this has to be done with significant stakeholder engagement. And so we've issued the first draft of the RFP that was issued last week. We are putting it out for public comment for 2 weeks so that our stakeholders can kind of look at the scope and look at the RFP, and from the very beginning, kind of help give us direction in terms of if they think we met the mark or if we've missed it. That public comment period will close on January 26th, and we will reissue the final RFP, and we will move forward with this process. But this is important, particularly in relation to some of the behavioral health work that we're going to talk about in future slides, and so I want to highlight this for the committee. So moving on to the next slide, payment. When I think a lot about the Medicaid program and the engine of the Medicaid program, it comes down to claims payment and claims adjudication and processing. And so in the Division of Healthcare Services, they are in many ways the engine of the Medicaid program. They are responsible for claims payment and for claims adjudication. And I think, as this committee is aware, for a significant period of time, what we considered fiscal agent responsibilities and the claims adjudication or the Medicaid Management Information System, the MMIS system, were provided under a single contract with a single vendor. The Division of Healthcare Services several years ago kind of split apart those two responsibilities and began to re-procure those. The fiscal agent contract was re-procured over the last several years. It transitioned from Conduit, who had held the fiscal agent responsibilities, to HMS Gainwell on April 1st of last year. So we are now approximately 10 months into that transition, maybe 9 months. I think my math may be bad. And we are getting to the point of stabilization. These are very large and complex transitions. And so, generally, I would say that the fiscal agent transition was successful. The committee may remember back in 2013 to 2014, there was another transition with both fiscal agent and MMIS claims, and that was a lot more challenging. So I think it's notable that, again, we're about 10 months into that fiscal agent transition, and things are generally going well.
I have a question on that. I mean, that was quite a while ago. I think I was getting my MBA at that time, and I was actually going to school with the person that worked at that place from ACS to Xerox, and there was another agency before that, and that was a quick transition change, I think, between those three physical payers. But it was exactly the same individuals running. It just basically bought out the operation. So is that what happened, or is this a completely new vendor, new business, new place, new employees, or do we just put a under new management label on the outside of the building?
To the chair, Senator Wilson, the fiscal agent contract is held by HMS Gainwell, which is an entirely separate company and I believe a competitor actually to Conduit.
Okay.
Different company.
I understand that, but having the contract, they could just say, hey, okay, we're going to buy your assets, and just it's the same entity, same sort of. I just didn't know if that's a separate. Do you know how? Same location for the payer agent, or is it a new location?
Through the chair.
New employees, I guess that's my.
Yeah, to the chair. There are some employees that have transitioned from Conduit to Gainwell over April. There are many employees who have not. So, part of the challenge, I know we talk about workforce challenges, but that fiscal agent transition was also challenged by workforce as we transitioned from Conduit to HMS Gainwell, which is an entirely new company There are some new locations that HMS operates out of. If you're familiar with Anchorage, their operations in Anchorage are largely based out of the building where the Petroleum Club is in. I don't remember the address for that. It's very close to the Frontier Building. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're in that location now. Again, there was some overlap with employees, but there was also some gaps, and it was a little bit of a struggle to fill some of those staffing gaps initially, and it continues to be a struggle, to be quite frank.
And HMS, don't they also have the contract for your Medicaid audits and some of that work as well? Is there any comment?
To the chair, I believe Myers and Stauffer does the majority of our Medicaid audit work.
And they no longer do any of the additional work of Medicaid claims, sort of auditing?
To the chair, I would like to get back to you on that. I know that we have a number of contractors doing various audits, and so I want to make sure that before I answer definitively yes or no, that I go back and ask the Division of Healthcare Services.
Thank you. And also, I guess a follow-up to that would be just make sure if there is, how is that sort of a firewall on how you manage claims versus doing the audits as well?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Please continue.
So staying on slide 11, another effort that is underway in relation to the adjudication of a claim system is kind of the second half of the procurement effort to kind of re-procure these contracts after almost a decade. So currently we are re-procuring the contract for the Medicaid Management Information Services. That's like the actual claims adjudication system that supports all of the Medicaid, most of the Medicaid claims payment. That procurement is underway, and you know the results of that procurement will, and the new contract will take effect January 1, 2025. So again, that's something to be tracking. That is a large contract and very important to the Medicaid program. One final note I would add is we're highly focused with both of these new contracts on customer service, as well as vendor accountability. And so we're constantly asking our vendors, both HMS Gainwell and in the procurement process for the MMIS system, you know, how are you going to provide customer service? And are there technology options that you could bring to us that would improve use of our systems, improve customer access, customer service? And again, similar to what we talked about with the Division of Public Assistance, how can we support our staff in kind of operating at the top of their licensure and the top of their ability? So we're actively pursuing that in both of these contracts. So moving on to the next slide, it's important to note the slide that I just talked about really focuses on most but not all Medicaid systems. So when we're thinking about claims payment and adjudication, again, that's the engine and kind of the lifeblood of the Medicaid program, and it is important for claims to be paid timely and accurately. And so, you know, in our current state, as I said earlier, most but not all Medicaid claims are paid out of the Division of Healthcare Service using that combination of the MMIS system and the fiscal agent system. There are certain claims specific to behavioral health services that are actually paid out of the through a contract that's held in the Division of Behavioral Health through an admin services organization contract that's currently held by Optum. So you can see in the blue box on the left-hand side, the current state where the majority of Medicaid claims are paid through a single Medicaid system, and then you have behavioral health claims that are paid through an admin services organization. In thinking about some of the challenges that we've heard about the behavioral health system through the work that we've undertaken with the Youth Behavioral Health Roadmap, listening to stakeholder feedback and provider feedback, the department working with the Division of Healthcare Services and Behavioral Health has determined that moving forward, effective January 1, 2025, we believe that it will be most efficient to pay all Medicaid claims out of the MMIS or fiscal agent structure that is in place through healthcare services. That will standardize and centralize Medicaid claims payment, and we believe that will result in more timely, accurate, and reliable payments to our behavioral health providers. So we are actively beginning and undertaking this transition. In addition, we recognize that part of the contract through the admin service organization was intended to focus on substantial provider support. How do we build out capacity for our behavioral health providers to function and bill in a Medicaid system? how do we expand the number of providers that are accepting Medicaid, and how do we provide the technical assistance that they need? We want to make sure that we continue to focus and build out opportunities to do that. And so we intend to procure services for a behavioral health organization that would specifically focus on behavioral health, capacity building, provider support, and technical assistance. We believe that by moving to a future state, we will be able to pay behavioral health claims timely and accurately and consistently, and we will also be able to provide additional support to our behavioral health providers so that we can help not only support their needs, but also to build out the continuum of care and offer more services to more Alaskans around the state.
Questions? Thank you for doing that. I know that, is that when the Optum contract ends, is 2025?
Chair Wilson, yes, the contract with the current ASO Optum ends at the end of calendar year 2024. So these new changes we anticipate will take effect January 1, 2025. So we have about 11 and a half months to initiate this process.
Has there been any improvement in timely payments with the current contractor? We still hear that a lot of folks are owed millions or hundreds of thousands of dollars in back pay. And I know of one agency who had to take out a loan of credit to until they can get back paid. I just didn't know if there's any improvement with the current ASO provider. And if not, can we just continue on with a breach of contract? I know that was an issue that the department thought about at one point in time.
Chair Wilson, we are continuing to work to improve the service that our behavioral health providers receive. I think we believe that ultimately moving back into the MMIS and the fiscal agent system is how we can address those most quickly and as rapidly as possible. These types of claim transitions are very complicated, and we have a new deputy director in the Division of Behavioral Health that has undertaken several of these types of transitions, and she is beginning to work with contractors to outline how to make that transition successful. But it is complicated because of the examples that you just described. And so we're faced with this challenge of how do we try to address the existing issues over the next 11 and a half months while also undertake a fairly complex transition without making the situation worse for our behavioral health providers. So we want to be thoughtful in what that transition looks like. If there is a way for us to accelerate that, we would consider it. But we think right now the earliest that we could make that transition is January 1, 2025.
Thank you. Also on the slide, you talk about 1115 claims. Is the department coming forth with any 1115 waivers this session that we should be looking forward to?
Chair Wilson, we intend to talk about that a little bit more in the transformation of care at the end of this discussion.
That sounds wonderful. We can wait to then. Thank you.
Thank you. So moving on to slide 13, you know, one huge area of focus for the department really involves looking at the behavioral health continuum of care. I know that we've talked about this issue with committee members. We've talked about it with stakeholders. We have spent the last several months traveling to different regions around the state and really engaging in listening to communities, to providers, to those impacted by behavioral health issues and either lack of access to those in their communities for themselves or their loved ones. And this is a top priority for the Department of Health. So I want to talk a little bit about kind of the boxes on the right, because there's a lot of different work happening on this topic, and sometimes it can be confusing how those all interrelate to each other. So I want to step back for a second and talk about the green box, which is what we think about as a comprehensive integrated mental health program plan. And you'll likely hear about this over the next several months. This is a plan that has to be reviewed and updated every 5 years. And we are in that five-year process that really looks at mental health and behavioral health services that are available, where the gaps are, where we need to be looking in the future for all Alaskans, regardless of the intensity of their needs or their age. Within that, we have also undertaken efforts to really develop a behavioral health roadmap for Alaska youth, and I know some of you have been involved in that effort. Some of you are on the steering committee for that. We spent over an 8 to 6 month period going out, like I said, to different regions and really trying to listen and to understand what the regional needs were, identify solutions, and think about how those could relate to a statewide plan for addressing the behavioral health youth continuum of care. And that effort, that yellow box there, really looks at all Alaska youth who have a behavioral health or mental health need. Within that, in the blue box, we've also talked about the Department of Justice report that was issued approximately a year ago. And that report was really focused on Medicaid-eligible Alaska youth who were at risk for institution. And so, you know, thinking about those three boxes, you can see the different focus populations within these various efforts. We also have on the right-hand side focus on complex care. This can span all ages, but it includes individuals who have co-occurring needs that cross multiple divisions and or departments.
And we'll take a brief at ease here. We are back on the record. We are going to adjourn. We have some other state business to attend to this evening that came up to us here. Our next meeting will be Tuesday, January 23rd. We'll hold initial hearing and intake and invited in public testimony on Senate Bill 115, Physician Assistant Scope of Practice, sponsored by Senator Tobin. And at that, we are going to adjourn with our Chair's deepest apologies to the presenters at 4:39 p.m.